Hello, I'm Jessica, and I'm going to be reading for you today from Ezra. We're going to be reading two different parts. We're going to read Ezra chapter 4, verses 1 to 5, and then we're going to skip down to verse 24 and go through to chapter 5, verse 5. So we're starting at Ezra chapter 4, verse 1. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, "Let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." Then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Then we're skipping down to verse 24. "Thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Now Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, son of Jozadak, set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. At that time, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates went to them and asked, 'Who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it?' They also asked, 'What are the names of those who are constructing this building?' But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped until a report could go to Darius and his written reply be received."
Thanks, Jessica. Well, hey, my name is Tom. If I haven't met you before, I would love to do that after we are done in here. Happy Mother's Day to you all. We're not going to preach a specific Mother's Day sermon. We're just going to keep going, sitting under the Word of God, as is our practice. And I think Ezra chapter 4, the way to summarize all of it in one single word, if you like titles, all that kind of stuff, is the word opposition. Opposition. And at the same time, when you think about Mother's Day, I imagine that if you are a mother, you know what it is to be opposed by a little two-year-old who does not like the sandwich that you made for them. Perhaps you know what it is to be opposed by a 13-year-old who has discovered the depths of all wisdom and knowledge and how silly you are just overnight. You know what it is to be opposed if you are a mother. And on a maybe a more serious note, there have been books written recently about shifts within at least Western society when it comes to opposition for faith. One of them will pop up on the screen. This is called Being the Bad Guys. And the author is basically pointing out that something like 100 years ago, if you said you were a Christian, that was often upheld as a virtuous thing, a right and a proper thing to say in a Western society. And that over the course of the last 100 years, it's shifted to being one among multiple options and then shifted to being maybe morally tolerable. And you may even in 2026 have experienced that sometimes in certain conversations, to say that you were a Christian puts you on the moral outside, and that you might have found yourself saying, "What? I'm the bad guy now? How did this happen?" You may know the sting of being opposed for your faith in a more personal way. You may know it in your workplace, and you may even know it from within your friendship group, or even more personally, you may know it from within your family and your extended family who don't share your faith and sometimes are not even that excited that you have your faith. All of this is not to be a surprise for us, because we follow Jesus, who was opposed all the way unto death. And so the night before he was betrayed, in John chapter 15, he said, "If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first." The early followers of Jesus understood this point. And so in 1 John, they pick up on the same note. They say, "Don't be surprised, my brothers and sisters, if the world hates you." And all of this with background as lead up, we're going to start in Ezra chapter 4. We're going to work our way through verse by verse. So if you've got access to the Bible in a printed form, or if you've got it on your phone, that's going to help you to keep track with what we're doing. Some of the verses will come up on the screen as well. Should we get started? Verse 1, here we go. When the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel. Now, just pause there. Background, if you've missed the last couple of weeks in church, what you need to know is that God's people were exiled. The Babylonians had conquered them, taken them off a long way away. But over time, the Persians had risen to power, so much so that they conquered the Babylonians. And the Persians had a different foreign policy. They said, you can go back, you can go rebuild the temple. In fact, here's a little bit of money to help you on your way. So this big group of people, after approximately 70 years, return to the land, ready to rebuild their temple. But there's a problem, because the land's not entirely empty. There have been people living there while they've been gone. And this is the account of their interaction with those people. So we're picking up in verse 2. They came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the families and said, let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God and have been sacrificing to him since the time of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. Now, on the surface, this is an excellent start to the interactions between the returned exiles, God's people, and the people who have been living in the land. They say, we'd like to help you build the temple. So far, so good, until you get to verse 3. But Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, you have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us. Now, has anybody, can I get a show of hands, have you ever used or been around the Bible Project? It's like a YouTube channel. They show introductory videos. They've got these excellent graphic illustrations. And 99% of the time, I have found the Bible Project to be incredibly helpful when you come to a book of the Bible, you want to understand it. But today, I find myself in a very unfamiliar position, because I'm going to disagree with the way the Bible Project interprets chapter 4. Now, I've talked to Jared, who's part of our preaching team and our acting senior minister, and he's with me. Thumbs up, right? Yeah, same team. And Lee Carter, who has written the growth group materials. Lee Carter, can I get a thumbs up? You're with us as well. Thank you so much. So it's not just me, and actually most of the commentaries that I've read will take the following position, that the Bible Project, in their introductory video, say that they should not have rejected the help. They should have accepted the help. And you can see that in the diagram here. It's just a screenshot from the video. You can see Zerubbabel, he looks pretty grumpy. You have no part. And down in the bottom corner, the people offering the help, they say, we just want to help, you know, we're the good guys. And I think they've slightly missed some of the clues in the text that lead us to how we're supposed to read this. The first clue in the text is in verse 1, where it says they're enemies. The second clue is actually in a different part of the Bible, where we get more information about these people. 2 Kings chapter 17 gives us that information. It says, they worshiped the Lord, but they also served other gods. So they come and they say, we seek your God. Now, is that true? Kind of. But they're saying, we seek your God and we also seek other gods. They're saying, we worship your God. Let us help us build your temple. But the problem is, they also worship other gods. Now, this exclusive claim will gain opposition in 2026, not just back in the book of Ezra. But the one true God doesn't want to be worshipped among many other gods. He doesn't want to be put in the soup with lots of other gods along the way. In fact, one of the big reasons that God exiled his people in the first place was because they were serving other gods alongside the one and true God. It's right at the front of the Ten Commandments, that you're supposed to not have any other gods before me. And so based on that textual clue, it actually seems pretty reasonable to say they've done the right thing in rejecting the help, even though this ultimately starts them on a track towards opposition. You can see in verse 4 that actually perhaps the motives of the people offering the help were not so pure. By their reaction when they're left out of the building project, verse 4, then the peoples around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and make them afraid to go on building. Now, One of the things that you might have found strange in the service so far already is that we skipped a big chunk of the Bible. We skipped verses 6 through 23. And you say, oh, what's going on with this church? Why are they skipping the Bible now? I want to try and just explain how this chapter works to try and make simple sense of it. But I need your deep concentration for the next 2 minutes. Can I get that? Deep concentration for the next 2 minutes. Because in verse 5, you see two Persian kings mentioned by name. It says they bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus. And we've added in the timestamp there, 559-530 BC. And down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia, 521-486. If you're really eagle-eyed, you say, what happened between 530 and 521 BC? There was another Persian king. I'm confident that I'm not saying it correct, but it's something like Cambyses. And the idea here is that the opposition to the rebuilding of the temple wasn't just for a moment, but it continued from Cyrus through to Cambyses and all the way through to Darius. Now you come to verse 6, which we didn't read out. Here's what verse 6 says. At the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, he's a fourth Persian king. It's a lodging accusation. And in verse 7, it says, in the days of Artaxerxes, he sounds like a similar guy, but he's actually a different guy. And so we've got the fifth king of the Persian Empire. And through all of these different kings who are being named, the idea is there's opposition to what God is doing. If you were really, really eagle-eyed in your growth group this week as you read through the chapter, you may have noticed that in verse 12, the thing they're opposed to is not so much the rebuilding of the temple, but their rebuilding of the walls, which tells you that it's the time of Nehemiah. So it's a future time. And here's the five Persian kings laid out for us. The idea here is that Cyrus is the guy who sends them back from exile. He says, you can go back, you can rebuild your temple. Cambyses doesn't get mentioned, but the opposition goes through. Darius is when the opposition continues until the opposition for the temple. Then in verse 6, there's opposition under the reign of Xerxes. Then in verse 7, and all the way through to verse 23, is the chronicling of the opposition under the time of Artaxerxes. And then you get to verse 24, which is going to take us from Artaxerxes all the way back to the time of Darius. And so verse 5, if you're looking at your Bible, chronologically continues in verse 24. I want you to imagine that you're going on a bushwalk around one of the national parks around here, and you're on the main fire trail, and you see a little side trail off to the side that eventually rejoins the fire trail. That's what verse 6 through 23 is. It says, there was opposition to what God's people were trying to do. That opposition continued. Now look, come back with me in verse 24 to the original opposition to the temple. And so if all of this was just a little bit kind of too much complexity and you got lost in the Persian kings, here's the point that the author of Ezra is trying to put out, which is that the opposition continues for a very, very, very long time. God's people have always faced opposition. In fact, we are coming out of a time often called Christendom, where there was a strange moment and it felt like maybe Christianity didn't get much opposition for a minute. And we're kind of coming out of that time again, back into a more normal time where God's people should get used to facing opposition again. This is why in the New Testament you get writings like 1 Peter chapter 4. It says, dear friends, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come on you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice in as much as you participate in the sufferings of Christ. God's people have always faced opposition, and it's very possible that you know that in your life. You didn't need me to tell it to you. Can I offer a couple of points of application before we come to chapter 5? The first point of application is for you if you are considering becoming a Christian. And by God's grace, this church is a place where many people every year put their faith in God for the very first time. And sometimes in chatting with you, I've noticed this. The idea is, if I become a Christian, all the difficult things in my life will get better, right? All the hard things will go away if I become a Christian, right? The problem is that when you read Ezra chapter 4 and then you pick up the idea that Christians are used to being opposed, it may make your life a bit easier it may make your life harder because you open yourself up to new forms of opposition when you put yourself out there as a Christian for the very first time. For some of us, application number two, we're sitting there kind of a little bit confused at this point because we say, yeah, I get it that God's people face opposition, but I don't feel much opposition in my life as a Christian. Maybe the last time that I faced opposition felt like a long time ago. And so should I be facing more opposition? Is there something wrong with me if I'm trying to do God's thing, but I haven't faced any opposition? At least two things you could say to that. One of the kind of tough love versions of responding to this question is you can say, yes, you should live more radically for Jesus. And the reason that you're not experiencing opposition is because you're not living for God in a full-on way. If you were salt and light in your workplace, you would stand out and you would receive opposition. So get out there and live more wholeheartedly this week. And it may be that that's the thing that you need to hear. There's another way of thinking about it, though, and it's to move out of the realm of individualism and to think about ourselves as part of the broader body of Christians. You're a Christian, which means you're God's daughter, you're God's son. The person sitting next to you, if they're a Christian, is the same thing. That makes you brothers and sisters. And worldwide, you have brothers and sisters who you've never met. Even in your growth group, if you think about this, you may not be being opposed, but the person on the other side of the circle might be. Or maybe think more broadly, and we think about the persecuted church, which is why Sally prayed for it today. This is a website, one of the groups that works with the persecuted church called Open Doors. They estimate, top left, that 1 in 7 Christians worldwide is persecuted for following Jesus. If you want to go on a deep dive with this, bottom left, they've got a thing called the World Watch List. They rank the top 50 countries where it's difficult to be a Christian, and the rankings change each year. And so Open Doors is a wonderful way to start thinking about other people who are opposed, praying for them, supporting them, if you're in the blessed position of not feeling much opposition in your own life. Hey, third point of application, it'll come up on the screen. If it's God's will, shouldn't it be easier? Have you ever felt this? You think, surely, if God told them to build the temple, wouldn't he have cleared a way? Wouldn't he have made that a smoother path? Doesn't the fact that it's difficult indicate they've done something wrong and they're not right in the middle of God's will for their life? The fascinating thing is that God did tell them to rebuild the temple, and he also allows the opposition to continue. When you skip forward to 1 Corinthians chapter 16, we studied 1 Corinthians recently as a church, you see Paul inhabiting an interesting mindset here. He says, I will stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost because a great door for effective work has opened to me and there are many who oppose me. You say, oh, surely that's a typo. Surely it's just about to say, but. It says, and. Paul sees no contradiction between living right in the middle of what God has for you and facing opposition for it. Now, it is possible that the opposition you face in your life as a believer is because you have been abrasive, or you have been unwise, or you've been just a little bit of a jerk about it. But it is also possible that the opposition you face in your life for following God is entirely acceptable, entirely to be expected, and entirely within the plan. We could summarize it like this. Sometimes it's God's will and it's difficult. It's not always smooth sailing. And on Mother's Day, it's probably worth pointing out that this is one of the things we try to teach our kids, right? Like they try to do something difficult. They try to climb a difficult bit at the playground. They say, this is hard. You don't say, oh, don't worry about it. Come over here, do something different. You say, let's talk about resilience. Let's talk about perseverance. I want to help you do difficult things because sometimes things are good and they're difficult. Sometimes things are God's will and we face opposition for them. What we're talking about today, Ezra chapter 4, is that God's people constantly face opposition. And we should, to some extent, expect the same thing in our lives today. And this has been a gloomy sermon so far. Let's go to chapter 5. It's actually going to be helpful for us as people who are opposed, and it's going to give us something to hang ourselves on when we need a little bit of encouragement. Verse 1 in chapter 5, now Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet. And by the way, if you've got a table of contents in your Bible, those are the two people who have a Bible book named after them. Often the whole Old Testament just looks like a bunch of unfamiliar names on a page to us, but we're in the book of Ezra, book number 1. And originally Ezra and Nehemiah are one combined book, so Ezra, Nehemiah. And in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, that's when Haggai and Zechariah do their thing. And this series, we've called it Home and Away, because at the same time that they've come home to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, the book of Esther is unfolding. And so you can put all five of these Old Testament books together, say Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Esther, they all belong together. So you can go for a deep dive. Zechariah is a bit long, but Haggai is two chapters. So if you need something to read this afternoon, Haggai is a good bet. You can see what they did to galvanize the people back into action to start rebuilding the temple even after it got put on pause. It says, now Haggai the prophet, Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them. Who was over them? And that's a clunky phrase. Every week we translate the sermon at 9:15 into Chinese for those of you who are listening through your headsets. And I was talking with Jennifer, who's hiding in the back room up the back there. Do you want to give us a wave? She was saying, what does yours say at the end of verse 1? I said, oh, it says, who was over them? She said, that's not in my Chinese translation at all, because it's just a clunky bit. And you say, why is that there in the first place? And in the same time, it does seem like that's actually the thing you need to know when you're being opposed, is who's over all of this? Who's behind all of this? Who's going ahead? Who's in the middle of all of this? Who sits beneath and is guiding the course of human history? You could say, you know who's over all of this is Cyrus, because he's the one who gave the decree and 42,000 people moved themselves 1,500 kilometers. He's the one who's over everything. You could say it's the enemies who get their way and they do get the temple work put on pause. They're the one who is over everything. You could say maybe it's Haggai and Zechariah because they're the ones who are able to galvanize the people back into the rebuilding project. But what the book of Ezra wants to show us is that through all of this, behind all of this, in every situation of their life and your life, God is over it. Even when it looks like he is absent. Then Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, son of Jozadak, set out to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So this is good news. The building project gets back underway. At that time, verse 3, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Sheth-Bozenai, and their associates, just say the name confidently, no one cares. Shethazar-Bozenai and their associates went to them and asked, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it? They also asked, what are the names of those who are constructing this building? And you say, oh no, the opposition is back. And they're taking a list of people who they can get in trouble for it. Verse 5, this is where we'll finish. But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews. Band, you guys want to come up to prepare yourselves? But the eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews. It's fun to think about God's eye. He doesn't have an eye organ like you and I do. You know, Jesus took on flesh when he entered into our world, but God himself in that sense doesn't necessarily have an eye, but he has a gaze. He has his attention fixed somewhere particular. He has his attention directed towards somebody. And what it's saying here is that God's eye is on his people when they are opposed. the king of Persia, who wanted to keep an eye on his empire, he'd send out riders on horses. They'd bring back a report. They were affectionately known as the Eye of the King. But God doesn't need people on horses to tell him what's happening because he sees it directly. Can we finish with this? The eye of their God was watching over the elders of the Jews. And do you know the difference between watching and watching over? Yeah, you see this every time you see Saturday sport, right? There's a dad on the sidelines and he's watching. Good job. And then there's an actual parent who's watching over. And it's an engaged word. It's a protector word. It's a mother word. It's a father word. And God is like that in the difficult circumstances of your life that have already happened this year and will happen the rest of the year. Some people think he's just watching, letting it play out. No, he's watching over. And it may be that what you needed to hear today is that God is over the difficult things that happen in our lives. His eye is on us when we are his opposed people. And he's not just watching, but he's watching over.